Blog Talk Radio.
Hit it! Good Tuesday evening. It is 8 p.m. Eastern Time in the U.S., and that means it's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser. I'm Steve Laser, and I thank you for deciding to spend a part of your evening with me. We have two topics in a slightly abbreviated show tonight. We're going to talk about the fiscal cliff and give some analysis and a potential end game that you might not have heard before. But first, maybe I should introduce myself a little better. At least how I got involved with politics. It occurred to me the other day that I've had about 15 shows. I'm starting to get a fair amount of you listening, and again, I thank you all for that. It's a real pleasure getting the chance to talk politics with you three times a week. But I think you all deserve to know why politics is so important to me. In so doing, I want to talk a bit about one of the most important events in presidential electoral politics of the past 100 years. But it's going to take a little bit of time to get there. Let's start at the beginning. I was born November 5th, 1968, in Long Island, New York. That year, November 5th was the first Tuesday in November, making it Election Day. And it was one of those election days that come around every 4 years when America selects a president. Richard Milhouse Nixon was elected to the presidency on the day I was born. Now, both of my parents were Democrats. My mother had to vote by absentee ballot in election 68. And I grew up in a home where politics was frequently discussed among the adult members of my family, and also between my parents and the adults with whom my parents were friends. My dad watched political programs on television every night, and my mother took me with her when she canvassed neighborhoods for the Equal Rights Amendment in the early 1970s. Every holiday, when I was taken to spend time with the extended family, I would listen to the discussions about politics. Now, while most of my extended family members were Democrats, just like my parents, some were Republicans, and the debates would get pretty lively on occasion. I remember one day, it must have been around the holidays in the late 1970s, when during one of these intense political discussions, I stood up and at around 10 years old, threw out a pretty good and lengthy posit regarding one of the political topics being discussed. I don't remember what topic it was or exactly what I said, but I remember the stunned silence as a room full of middle-aged and older adults stared at this kid that had just made a pretty good political argument. So politics has always been important to me. But there are two very critical events that I always point to that altered my perception of politics and decided for me, really, how involved I wanted to get. The first event was when I enlisted in the U.S. Air Force. Now, up until my enlistment, I had lived basically all of my life in the Northeast United States, or, as I also call it, Liberal Central. Republicans were nothing more than cute contrarians to me when I was growing up. In the New York City metro area, any time a Republican opened their mouth to talk about politics, there were 8 Democrats that would speak up to refute their points, or at least it seemed that way to me as a kid. But I enlisted in the Air Force, and the next thing I knew, I was at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, for basic training for 6 weeks. It was 6 weeks back then. They've since moved it to 8 weeks. Then I was at Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas, for technical training. And then I was sent to Cheyenne Mountain Air Force Base, Colorado Springs, Colorado, for my base of assignment. Now, I got to tell you that the political environment that I found in those places was a complete shock to me. Everywhere I went, it seemed I was the only Democrat around. The years were 1989 through 1992 that I was in Colorado Springs. Reagan had just left office, and everyone in those places had memorized all the things that Reagan had said about liberals by heart, and they were being thrown at me every time I tried to talk about politics. If I had a dime for every time I heard the line, the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. If I had a dime for each time I heard that when I was in Texas or Colorado, it would probably make me a millionaire. To this day, I haven't met too many liberals in their early 20s ready to refute the spin that Reagan put on politics. And let's not forget, it was new back then. Okay, this shtick that we hear from the Boehners and the Limbaughs and all those folks, that was new. It took the Democratic Party's best candidates and analysts a while to deal with the new conservative spin that Reagan brought to the country. In many ways, I think we're still learning how to deal with it. But here I was, a young liberal kid in the military, deep in red Republican territory. I have to say that it taught me a lot how you needed to discourse with Republicans if you're heavily outnumbered. Just as important, though, it drove the point home that just as some of the areas of the country are heavily liberal, there are heavily conservative areas, too. Now, that might not seem like that big of a revelation to most of you. And maybe when you say it, it doesn't sound like one. But I have to tell you, it's one thing to see the red districts and states on the map on Election Day. It's quite another to live among the people in those areas for years at a time and talk a lot of politics with them. When you do that, you really understand the challenge that Democrats face in enacting policy. Now, I hear from a lot of liberal and progressive folks who complain, why can't the Democrats just get X or Y policy done? Why can't Obama just do, you know, whatever super progressive thing that they want him to do? Now, I know the answer to the question, but it's difficult to convince other folks of how real that answer is unless you've lived it. But fast forward to the 1990s, and I had gotten out of the Air Force and was living in Pinellas County in Florida, when I was approached by a person who wanted me to work for a campaign of someone running for the state Senate in my area. And that person was Kathy Castor. Now, Ms. Castor lost that election, but went on later to win the right to represent that area in the U.S. House of Representatives. And she's been a congressman ever since. That was the first campaign I got involved with in the run-up to election 2000. Shortly after I met Ms. Castor's campaign folks, I also got involved in the Nelson for Senate campaign in 2000 and the Gore for President campaign. I think you all can see where this is leading. Suffice to say that what I saw from Republicans in election 2000 in Florida was enough to change me from someone who was content to think about politics at home now and then and watch politics on TV, to someone who wanted to be deeply involved every day. I've written a number of articles about my opinion on election 2000, but let me sum up a bit here. First, if there had been an honest vote in Florida, Gore would have won. And Gore would have won by at least a full percentage point. However, most people look at the wrong place in determining where the election was stolen. Yes, the New York Times said in an article, in the body of the article, that if a complete recount of all counties was done, Gore would have won Florida. And even though the title of that article is misleading, the title says Bush wins even if the ballots were counted. But the text of the article says if a full count of a full recount of all ballots in Florida was done, Gore wins. But the Chads were not the story of that election. There were two main ways that the Republican Party stole the 2000 election. And the first is that Katherine Harris, then the Secretary of State of Florida, ordered an aggressive purge of voters from the rolls several months before Election Day. She hired a consulting firm to decide who to purge. See, Florida, back in those days, this has changed, but back in those days, if you were a convicted felon, you got purged from the voter rolls. So those folks were needing to be purged from the rolls each election. And also, if you moved to another state and you you basically hadn't voted in, is it two or three elections? I don't know. But either way, folks who haven't voted in a certain amount of time are supposed to be purged. So you had two groups of people that were supposed to be purged. But Harris hired a consulting firm who to purge, and they offered her three different scenarios. One was not fairly aggressive, then there was one that was sort of in the middle of the road as far as aggressiveness, and one that was very, very aggressive. The very aggressive method was that basically if your name looked even close to the name of a convicted felon, you'd get purged. If your name was William Smith and Bill Smith was a felon, there's a chance that you would have gotten purged. And Harris chose the super aggressive scenario. Now, when she did that, the firm warned her that it would likely purge a lot of eligible voters. She didn't care because she noticed that it purged a lot of African-American-sounding names from the rolls. In fact, the methodology that was selected by Harris was analyzed after the election, and it was proven to show that it purged about 10,000 of what should have been eligible voters from the rolls. And more than 50% of those voters were African-American. If you apply the 2000 exit poll demographics to those 10,000 voters, because well over 90% of African-Americans voted for Al Gore, you get a net of around 2,000 more votes for Gore. Since the ultimately certified count in Florida had Bush ahead by exactly 537 votes, if you give 2,000 more votes to Al Gore, you know, proves that Catherine Harris' purge gave Bush the election regardless of hanging chads or butterfly ballots. Now, those of us heavily involved in the campaign in Florida were aware of that very early on in the recount. The second most important story about Election 2000 and the recount is what the Florida State Legislature did near the end of the process. Most people don't know this. Most people don't remember this if they did know it at one time. The Florida State Legislature, about 70% of whose seats were held by Republicans at that time, voted to give Florida's electors to Bush regardless of the outcome of the event, of the recount. Now, each candidate has electors that they choose from each state, and by choosing to give Florida's electors to Bush, it means Bush's electors were to go to Washington and vote in the Electoral College for Bush. Now, again, the Florida legislature, before the recount was done, voted to give Florida's electors to Bush, regardless of the outcome of the recount. I want everybody to think about that, okay? 70% of the seats of the Florida State Legislature were held by Republicans. They voted to give the electors to Bush, regardless of the outcome of the recount. That vote was held December 11, 2000, the day before the Supreme Court ruled. Okay, and that vote effectively made the Supreme Court vote and decision moot, although most people still don't understand that. Now, you may ask yourself, how is that possible? How could the Florida State Legislature do that? How can the legislature of a state give the electors to a presidential candidate if the voters chose another candidate? And the answer is the Constitution says they can, sort of, right? Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution says, in part, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years, and together with the vice president, chosen for the same term, be elected as follows. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. Let me repeat. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. Technically, the state legislature of any state can decide which slate of electors will vote in the Electoral College without having the citizens of that state vote ever. the state legislature of any state can say that you personally can decide who will get that state's electors, or me, or any other group. It's in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct. Now, I'm sure that there are legal arguments to be made that doing it the way that the Florida legislature did on December 11, 2000 is not okay. Maybe it's ex post facto. Maybe it contravenes existing Florida law on how the electors should be appointed, et cetera, you know. But generally, the legislature of the state has absolute constitutional power over the electors of that state and how they are to be chosen. There's no question that what the Florida state legislature did in December of 2000 is highly immoral. And I'm sure that 99% of the people hearing this from me are disgusted by it, as you should be. If the Supreme Court had allowed the recount to continue and Gore had won it, his electors would have gone to vote in the Electoral College, and the Bush Florida electors would have also gone because of the action of the Florida state legislature. Now, if there's a conflict like that, the electors of that state are thrown out. And if without the electors of those of that state, there are enough votes so that there are 270 electoral votes for one of the candidates, without that state's electors, it's no big deal. We have a president. We have an election. We have a winner. That would have not been the case in 2000. Nobody would have gotten 270 electoral votes without Florida. So what would have happened is that the election would have been thrown into the Congress with the House choosing the president and the Senate choosing the vice president. Because of the makeup of those houses at the time that the Electoral College would have been voting and when the election would have been thrown into the Congress, Bush would have become president because the House would have been Republican. And let me say that, you know, we know that the House had a majority of Republican, but the way that the House votes in those cases is by state delegations. But even that would have favored Republicans. So that Bush would have been president. But the Senate was Democratic. So Joe Lieberman would have become George W. Bush's vice president. So in short, if the Supreme Court had let the recount go on and mandated a full recount, and Gore had won the count in Florida, we still would have had a President Bush because of what the Florida state legislature had done. Most people don't realize that. That sealed the stolen election. Now, I saw that all happen before my eyes in slow motion over 6 to 8 weeks or so. I thought about it for a few months, and then I joined the Pinellas County Democratic Executive Committee, and that ultimately led to me writing articles, getting picked up by online news agencies, and my appearances on Fox News and the RT Network and other television and radio networks. So in a sense, I'm a direct blowback on the Republican Party from their shenanigans in Florida in 2000. By the way, some other important notes of election 2000. An analysis of the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County. I hope you all remember that. It's this controversial ballot arrangement that ended up giving a whole bunch more votes to Pat Buchanan that people actually meant to give to George W. That people actually meant to give to Al Gore. So much so that Pat Buchanan said, "Yeah, those votes are probably not mine. They probably belong to Al Gore." The analysis of the butterfly ballot says that the butterfly ballot cost Al Gore a net of around 6,200 votes. You add that to the votes that the Catherine Harris purge cost Gore, and Gore should have won Florida by over 7,500 votes without counting chats. So, yes, Al Gore had election 2000 stolen from him. There's no question about it. George W. Bush was an illegitimate president. I don't even recognize the 2004 election results, primarily because Bush shouldn't have had the advantage of incumbency behind him. Without that advantage, Kerry beats him easily. Bush even almost lost with that advantage. But getting back to the Republican Party shenanigans in Florida, the upshot is that because the Catherine Harris voter purge worked to change the result in 2000, the Republicans have been working that angle in every presidential election ever since. Every time you have a Republican administration in charge of a traditional swing state, you see Republicans trying to initiate aggressive voter purges that they hope will unfairly put the odds of winning the election in their favor. They tried to do it in Pennsylvania this year. They tried to do it in Florida this year. They tried to do it in Ohio this year. It's going to take, and I said this when I did my segment on voter suppression before the election. It's going to take a big and embarrassing event or series of events to get them to stop it. If it's one thing that I've learned from watching Republicans these oh so many years, it's that when a tactic works, they keep using it. So that's all I have on introducing myself to you and the 2000 Florida recount. I hope you enjoyed that. On to the fiscal cliff update. If you're like me, you're sick of hearing about the fiscal cliff. It's starting to get boring, right, and annoying and irritating. Every day we hear more about how there's an impasse. Then the next day there's potential hope for a solution, and we're at an impasse again. But I got a new take on it that I want to share with you all. A lot has been made about Grover Norquist and the pledge that his organization has Republican lawmakers sign that says that they're not going to raise taxes or institute new ones. That's a big obstacle to a solution. We all know that, right? Republican lawmakers are terrified of being perceived as having broken their pledge. Think about this, however. Let's say that no deal is reached, and on January 1, taxes are automatically raised on everyone, and the massive spending cuts go into effect. If on January 2nd, the Republican members of Congress then vote to give everyone except the wealthy a tax cut, but keep the wealthy where they are as of January 2nd, which is at 39.6%. On January 1st, it would raise from 35 to 39.6%. If they do that, then the Republican lawmakers, members of Congress, are honoring the pledge they made, but they're still giving the president what he wants. Let me say that again. If on January 2nd, the Republican members of Congress then vote to give everyone except the wealthy a tax cut, but keep the wealthy where they are as of January 2nd, which is at 39.6%, they are honoring their pledge. Now, I have a strange feeling that that's about to happen, that's what's going to happen. And it's one of the more bizarre things that I've seen in politics. If the Republican members of Congress vote that to put that solution into effect right now, then technically they'd be raising taxes on the wealthy and in violation of their pledge. But if they wait and vote to put that exact end state into effect on January 2nd, they have not violated their pledge. So here's how this plays out. Boehner and the other Republicans attack President Obama and vice versa in the press for the next 27 days. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, they're secretly negotiating to put together a compromise that they'll implement on January 2nd. The compromise will include spending cuts on various programs, but not Social Security and Medicare or Medicaid, and taxes will be raised on the wealthy. Cut for everyone, but the wealthy will stay exactly where they are on January 2nd at 39.6%, where the fiscal cliff would put them. Both groups will claim victory. The deficit will be reduced. The middle class continues to get tax relief. And we get to be rid of Grover Norquist for a while, who will have to be content to stew quietly in some corner somewhere. Will it happen like that? I don't know. I don't know if that's what they're doing. But it is a neat trick. And it's a trick that avoids anyone having to look bad. In politics, from what I've seen, events tend to favor solutions where all sides get the safe face. That's all I have for this evening. I thank you all for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 8 p.m. Eastern Time this Thursday, December 6th. Until then, have a great evening and a great rest of your week.
Hit it!